Welcome to the Brainstorm, episode 91. Today we're talking stablecoins. We've got Lorenzo and Ray Hadi. Ray, new to ARK, first time on the Brainstorm. Let's just do quick intro before we dive in.
Yeah, so I joined the ARK team as a digital asset research associate about almost 2 months ago. So a background mainly in the crypto space, a couple of years of that in school and out of school, but you know, really excited to be here, part of the team.
Awesome. And so stablecoins in the mind, I feel like, of everyone in crypto for a while, clear trends up and to the right in terms of adoption. I feel like, you know, we just had the Circle IPO where it shot through the roof. And so now it's starting to cross the radar of a lot of more traditional finance people and people outside of crypto. So maybe we just start there of what is a stablecoin?
You want me to get this one?
Yep.
Sweet. So, I mean, I like to think about stablecoins as just a token that is minted on chain that kind of is pegged to a dollar value. So a lot of people think of crypto, they think of volatility. So this kind of allows you to then, you know, leverage the benefits of blockchain without the, you know, volatility of something like Bitcoin or another token. And then in terms of stablecoin, usually we'll see two types. You'll have the reserve-backed stablecoins, and that's something like Circle or USDT, so Tether. And those, basically, that's, you have a claim to the reserves they have backing these, you know, dollars existing on chain. And then the other types, you'll have something like DAI, that's collateral, like debt position. So you put up 150% debt, and then you get a dollar's worth of that stablecoin. And there's a ratio that you have to maintain, but it's a little more of a decentralized way of having a stablecoin. But I think the best way is just dollar value token on chain.
Gotcha. And so on that piece of being backed by the dollar versus not, I feel like this is a common question of the validity of stablecoins, of is it helping the US dollar expand its reach, or is it actually eating into dollar dominance? Lorenzo, you just wrote a blog here on this. So what is your take on stablecoins and the US dollar here?
Yeah, I think I would say definitely reinforce the dollar's dominance. I think, you know, there's a few ways to look at it, but, you know, Bitcoin and Ether, they're, you know, the two biggest cryptos right now by market cap and trading volume in general. If you want to trade any of these assets, you know, in the US, but even in Asia or Europe, those are quoted in USD denominated stablecoins, right? And I think that's like a very powerful moat that creates demand for these stablecoins. So that's kind of number one. Number two is really the use cases of stablecoin in general have gone kind of past speculation, and we have, you know, real adoption. And so if you look at the patterns and usage of Tether and USDT in general, in emerging markets, people are actually using, you know, as a store of value, right? And or using it to pay in stores and general just commerce. And so I think you know, not to get into politics, but you know, with, you know, de-dollarization and, you know, the tariffs, I think this is definitely a counterbalancing kind of force. So yeah, and again, like supply, you know, just supply, usage, volume, pretty much every metric that you look at has been trending higher for the past, you know, year and a half, I would say.
All right, you said two things, so let's dive into them sequentially. First, you said Tether and USDT, and then you also said emerging markets. So what is Tether? What is USDT? Who are the players here? And, you know, is every single company going to have their own stable coin? Does it make sense to just have one? What are the competitive dynamics here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. Tether is the biggest stable coin. So overall, like total market cap is about 250 billion. Tether has about 160 billion and Circle around 60 billion. So between both of them, they basically have 85% market share right now. You know, whatever metric you want to look at, active number of wallets, volume, supply, they're basically the two behemoths in the space. They're very similar in terms of structure and collateral. I would say Circle is more regulated. And obviously now with the IPO and the Genius Act in the US even more, Tether is overseas, has kind of a different user base and is not fully backed by treasury bills or cash or repo agreements or cash collateral. They also have a portion that is backed basically by Bitcoin. And so they're not fully backed, you know, like Circle, I would say, with a stable, you know, collateral. So that's the main, you know, difference. And that's the big reason why they're not in the US right now. And they have, again, like a completely different user base in emerging markets, Southeast Asia, India, you know, Eastern Europe, and even Latin America.
And so, yeah, is this a winner take most market? Or, you know, in Brainstorm, we were talking, right? It's like Uber had essentially a stable coin, right? You give them money, they give you Uber credits, and there's a discount on it. So that's like kind of like a yield there. Is this every single company kind of does some sort of, you know, dollar credit for their patrons or whatever to build up loyalty? Or is this a, you know, two player market or even a one player market longer term?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely like too early to tell how many, you know, players are going to be. But I think one thing to keep in mind is the cost, like the overhead cost of just like running the stablecoin infrastructure, you know, having the reserves, maintaining, you know, compliance, and then integrating with, you know, different blockchains, different institutions to kind of, I guess, facilitate your specific stablecoin, and especially as a stablecoin issuer. So I think it's very likely that we do see growing dominance from, you know, incumbents like Tether and Circle. But at the same time, you know, there's definitely going to be a lot of potential for new entrants, especially, you know, banks or institutions, because, you know, like you mentioned, something like Uber, it is attractive to launch your own stablecoin and completely vertically integrate that whole infrastructure. But at the same time, there's a lot of costs, you know, difficulty, regulatory overhead, that it might be easier to just onboard, you know, a Circle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sam, I think, you know, a good way to look at this, I mean, first of all, like, you know, in the Genius Act, actually big tech, they're not going to be allowed to launch stablecoins. That's kind of one of the points. So that's number one. Obviously, I think otherwise it would make a lot of sense for Meta, Google, or even some of these, you know, tech giants to actually launch their own stablecoin. Look, at the end of the day, it's definitely, it has a liquidity moat. It's money, right? So I think, you know, when you look at ARK and other like big institutions, I think there's two big things that you want is legitimacy and, you know, being sure that it's fully kind of collateralized, and then liquidity, right? You don't want to be holding something that then if you want to make like a venture investment or you have to pay or you have to buy an asset for any fund or product that you have, that the counterparty is not going to receive it for a number of reasons, right? And so I think based on kind of those two criteria, it's pretty obvious that there is going to be, you know, it's probably not going to be a very, very fragmented market. Mm-hmm. We've seen like fintechs in general, you know, Robinhood, BitGo, there's a few fintech and crypto natives that are doing a consortium and that are launching their own stablecoin. PayPal has its own stablecoin that hasn't really grown much like in the past years. So I think we'll have different approaches. Banks are definitely, I would say, the biggest threat here, either launching their own stablecoin or even, you know, white labeling, you know, USDC infrastructure or some other, you know, provider. I think that's definitely a possibility, and we'll see that. But I think at the end of the day, especially for Circle, you know, they're building a lot of underlying infrastructure to use stablecoins. You know, for financial institutions, like, you need compliance, you need like KYC tools, you need chargebacks, you need, you know, privacy to be able to transfer these tokens. So that's a lot of infrastructure that, you know, these stablecoin providers are slowly building. And so I think it's going to be harder and harder to catch up with them, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if you see it as a pure kind of B2B business, once you're kind of in the network, it's going to be very hard to come out of that. So yeah, we definitely think it's going to be a 2, 3, 4 kind of player market.
Got it. And then Ray, maybe you can walk us through Nick Carter, was talking, I mean, he's been big on stable coins for a very long time, gave a great analogy on Twitter, brought us back. I feel like, you know, when we first started talking about Bitcoin and saying, oh, you know, it's a unseizable asset, and people in the US just say, who cares, right? It's like, why don't you put it in a bank? What is the analogy here? And do you think it holds water?
Yeah. So the tweet that Sam's referencing is basically Nick Carter alluding, or, you know, comparing stablecoins to Neuralink, in a sense where
Starlink.
Slip of the tongue there. Starlink, where basically Starlink provides you know, digital, like, you know, internet infrastructure to communities that in the past didn't have that infrastructure available to, you know, maybe they didn't have the fiber optics cables or the investment necessary from their government to have a reliable internet. And Starlink provides that to them at, you know, very low friction, very low cost. And that, you know, enables a ton of possibilities in terms of, you know, having internet access in these regions that didn't. And stablecoins do the same thing, but that's more for the financial infrastructure. So a lot of these regions did not have the, I guess, formal property rights or digital infrastructure to enable, you know, financial transactions, you know, leverage like productive capital, that type of thing. And now through stablecoins and, you know, crypto, having this all on the blockchain rails, you can do this, you know, just through a smartphone, and it's completely, you know, frictionless, just like you see with Starlink for internet. So that's kind of what the analogy is referring to. And I think I would say it definitely holds, or definitely has legs. Specifically, one thing we mentioned in the brainstorm was Hernando de Soto's framework on property rights, and basically how that, or I guess one of the main things he mentions is the concept of dead capital. And when you're in these regions with very little, I guess, formal property rights, very little infrastructure to enforce that, you have a lot of capital that you say maybe you own a house or you own an asset, but because there is very little enforcement of your ownership, you can't leverage it to take out, you know, a loan or to build credit or anything that would make it more productive. And therefore it hurts, you know, economic growth and prosperity of those regions. And the thing with stablecoins and crypto here, he's talked about Bitcoin providing this, and crypto does the same thing. And stablecoins, I would say, would be an even better, you know, use of this due to the fact that it's stable. So you're not having to store your wealth in Bitcoin. That was enabling you these digital property rights, but you get stability as well. So you get, you know, something that's not volatile, but you can, and like in this case, store your wealth in something, have that digital infrastructure, and then, you know, you get that flywheel of economic prosperity and productive capital. So definitely has legs. And I think, you know, we're definitely seeing it through Tether in their, you know, position in emerging markets.
And so then what is the business model for a stable coin? Is this a, you know, the more people who use it, obviously that's good. Are you getting money off of transactions? Is it just scraping some of the difference between what's backing it and what you're offering the holders of it? What's the business model, and how do you think about the future model of it?
Yeah. Well, first off, the main, I guess, like the business model that we've seen through looking at Circle is definitely the reserve backing, because a lot of these, like the composition of these reserves is usually T-bills that are, you know, yield bearing. So the issuers earn a lot of revenue of their revenue through these reserves. But additionally, there's a lot of other revenue sources like, you know, transaction fees. I know Circle is looking at a Circle payments network. That's going to be something that's going to, you know, yield transaction fees. Additionally, they have other services like redemptions that they earn fees on. Additionally, they have a, what is it? USDYC that they have private credit, like real world on-chain private credit that they're using as well. So there's a couple different, you know, I guess, revenue streams that they have there. I don't know if you have any others you'd like to add.
Yeah, I mean, Sam, you can look at it. There's one on the supply. So obviously the $60 billion worth of stablecoin, there's a portion of that that is in short-dated treasury bills that are yielding, you know, 4 or 5%. So Circle gets that, you know, that is not distributed to users. So that is the biggest revenue stream right now. They also have, so USDYC, which is their tokenized money market, where that is also yielding, you know, a yield, and they're taking, you know, a take rate on that. And then they have their own bridge. So, you know, if you have USDC on Ethereum and you know, want to go to Solana, you can use like a number of kind of canonical or third-party bridges. Circle has CCTP, which is their main bridge. And so they're monetizing that right now. Also, if you want to bridge USDC from Ethereum to Optimism or to Solana. And so that is more related to kind of the velocity, you know, of money and the volume. And then they're also developing the CPN, the Circle Payment Network, which is more, you know, kind of a Swift or Visa type of network with compliance modules. So really like for institution, fintechs, like cross-border payment companies. It launched a week ago. And so, you know, we'll see how that develops. But there's a lot of monetization opportunities there in terms of either, you know, take rate on volume and or like on off and on ramp, you know, from USDC to fiat in local currencies. So we'll see. But those are basically the revenue streams right now.
Yeah. And then one last thing I'd like to add, just back with the kind of like Nick Carter analogy, like bringing stable coins to these emerging markets. There's like, you know, billions or trillions of dollars of capital that are locked in like unproductive, you know, dead capital, like Hernando de Soto likes to call it, that stable coins could potentially unlock, that, you know, could, you know, even if you're earning, you know, a basis point of a fee on, you know, and billions of trillions of dollars in value, that could be significant.
And so then obviously, as we wrap this up, got to go the convergence route here. AI, agents, online commerce, everything, you know, is stablecoin going to be the rail of the future for all of these AI agents to transact? Or will they go with a more traditional route that ties in? It's like, oh, you're AI agent can know your credit card, so it doesn't really need a stable coin. Or what's the, I guess, benefit of going stable coin and AI native?
Yeah, I think definitely one of the biggest questions. I think if you look at, you know, like AI agents, they obviously, stable coins are built like on blockchain rail with smart contracts. So it's like, it's code, it's programmable. You have finality, right? Like with a credit card, like when you purchase something, if you imagine like the agent, which, you know, basically has to act on, you know, if something happened, they'll do this, they'll do that. You probably need like quasi instant finality, right? And that's something that actually blockchains give you that traditional finance doesn't give you. Like it's, you know, day plus one, day plus two for to settle in many transactions, many types of transactions. And so that's, you know, number one. Number two, I think in terms of use cases, there's just so many loops and new use cases that you can do on blockchains. Like flash loans is something I'm sure going to be used much more by AI agents. Like, you know, types of arbitrage that don't really exist like in traditional finance. And then on the other side is just like capital formation, right? Like if you, we've seen the meme coin craze. I think one, you know, we're not particularly bullish on meme coins, but like it is like a type of capital formation, right? And you could see one of these AI agents basically get capital, you know, get basic through a token and some other kind of way, and then start to transact and be productive on chain. I think that is also very, very interesting, and maybe figuring out like new monetization type of avenues. So there's definitely a convergence, obviously. I think stable coins are probably the, you know, I would say the biggest bet in terms of, you know, where these AI agents are going to transact. You need, you know, a very cheap environment, again, like pretty fast finality. The TAM is much bigger. You can transact, you know, pretty much anywhere. And so I think it has a lot of, you know, a lot of points going, a lot of tailwinds. We'll see. But yeah, definitely exciting, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I'd agree with everything Lorenzo just said. And I think like the two main things he said that I believe and I think are the, you know, biggest convergence that you have are one, like digitally native, obviously that would make sense for AI. And then two, like deterministic, like he talked about it's code, it's programmable. And, you know, with these smart contracts, you know, whatever parameters are set, however they're supposed to work, that's how it works, you know, 100% of the time. And it's a lot easier for AI to interact with that versus something that may be a little less deterministic, that's a little, you know, more manual, you know, and requires human intervention.
Amazing. Are there any critiques of stablecoins that you think are particularly valid or worth watching? Or is this, you know, 50 years from now, stablecoins are M1 or M2? Like what's the concern? And then what's the limit as to how far this goes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern would probably be in terms of risk of depegging, right, and liquidity. I think, you know, with the Genius Act, we're going to have much more certainty in terms of and transparency in terms of the collateral, the on-off ramp kind of mechanism for at least like the big players, which are the ones that really matter the most. So I think that's one concern. You know, during the Silicon Valley Bank crisis, you know, USDC depegged to I think 85 cents or something like that. So I think it's really in the mind of people that I would say is one big concern. The other one is probably like privacy, right? Like, you know, most of the transactions right now in the US are obviously digital. So some kind of digital, if it's like Wire, Venmo, Cash Apps, stablecoins are, you know, using blockchain rails. They're not fully private. They're, you know, pseudo anonymous, but there's actually, you know, we have a lot of tools right now to actually figure out with good detail, you know, who's transacting and who's holding that. And Circle can freeze, you know, a lot of these accounts if it's for illicit purposes. So I would say privacy is also another big concern, I would say. And then I would say like banks in general getting into this vertical with privacy, you know, privacy concerns. So yeah, I think that those two are the biggest concerns I would say right now.
And Ray, what's the limit? How far can it go?
I mean, I think like you said, you were talking about like M1, M2 supply. Like if the US does embrace stablecoins and we start seeing, you know, like we're seeing with the Genius Act, we start seeing like progressive regulation on this front. We start seeing banks onboarding and, you know, people start actually, which I think they are today, realizing the benefits of, you know, running payments on blockchain rails. It could be, you know, I don't want to say limitless, but, you know, it could be the, you know, entire supply that we mentioned earlier. So I think the, you know, the bar is at the ceiling at this point.
I mean, Sam, yeah, just I would say like they're all backed by short dated treasury bills, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not going to have like the whole money in the world in stable coins, at least like with T-bills, because there's a reason we don't, you know, you and I don't hold actually treasury bills like on a day-to-day basis. Like you are taking some risk, right? In terms of pricing and in terms of liquidity. So yeah, we're probably not going to have like 90% of the money in the world that is in stable coins, at least with this mechanism and structure. But right now we're roughly like 1% of the M2 US money supply. So I think we still obviously have kind of way to go. We are modeling like in the next 5 years around like, you know, the total stablecoin supply to be roughly like 1.4, 1.5 trillion. So that gives you an idea. You know, today we're at 250 billion. So yeah, it's still exponential growth, I would say.
Gotcha. Amazing. Lorenzo, Ray, thank you for breaking down stablecoins today. And Ray, glad to have you on board and make the Brainstorm debut.
Awesome. Appreciate it, Sam.
Thanks, Sam.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other. And therefore, ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.